This week, it's another doubleheader, starting off with the Canadian fright slash sci-fi slash gore flick, The Void. And after that, we're going to be discussing the new film from Sean Byrne, director of one of our favorite horror films here at Sordid Cinema, The Loved Ones. His new movie is called The Devil's Candy.
We bring you this special radio television broadcast in order to give you the very latest information on an amazing phenomenon. Just a minute, ladies and gentlemen, I think something is happening.
Good evening. I hope you'll excuse me if I appear a trifle excited.
What we've got here is failure to communicate.
I want all of you to get up out of your chairs.
Whatever appears emerges as raw experience for those who watch it.
You unlock this door with the key of imagination. Beyond it is another dimension. A dimension of sound. A dimension of sight.
Hey, you're listening to Sordid Cinema, the official film podcast of SordidCinema.com. My name is Simon Howell. I'm joined, as always, by Mr. Ricky D.
Hello, Simon.
And this week, we're very pleased to inform you that we're joined by special guest, Victor Stiff.
Hey, guys.
And if it's not already obvious from the tenor of my voice, I'm very sick, and this is just a very unpleasant experience right now. But hopefully it won't be for you. So we're doing a twofer of independent horror films. We're going to start off by talking about the Canadian gore fest, The Void. And then we're going to talk about a little movie called The Devil's Candy. Fun trivia. I was supposed to watch both movies, and I really pushed for us to do The Devil's Candy because I was a huge fan of the filmmaker's previous film, The Loved Ones. But then at some point, due to my illness-induced delirium, among other factors, I totally forgot to watch it. So I will be joining in for the review of The Void, but I will merely be guiding the review of The Devil's Candy. So apologies to all concerned. All right. But before we get into it, obviously, if you haven't been checking out SordidCinema.com, checking out Goomba Stomp as well, you've been missing out. We've got so much stuff going up lately. I wanted to specifically mention, I know that Mike Warby just wrote a piece about why you should be watching HBO's The Leftovers, which is a show that is near and dear to my heart and which just started its third season. So if you needed a set of reasons to watch it, you should check that out. Ricky, anything else we should mention?
As per usual, you can listen to our podcast over at SordidCinema.com. You can listen to us via Stitcher, iTunes, Google Play, and I guess that's about it. You can follow us on Facebook. We actually have a Facebook page specifically for the podcast, Sordid Cinema Podcast, which you can find the link over on the post for this podcast. But of course, we also have the fan page. Either or, if you really want to connect with us, then yeah, join our Facebook group, which I should use more often, but I don't know. We'll get to it.
Yeah, we got a lot to coordinate. We've been using Slack for internal discussions and all sorts of stuff. We're growing, evolving. You know, it's a hustle, man.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, cool. So let's get to it with a clip from The Void.
Haven't you ever wished to save someone beyond saving, no matter what the cost?
This is uncharted territory.
The body has to adjust, of course.
We weren't built for this kind of thing. You'd be surprised at the things you find when you go looking.
There is something calling them all here.
Those people get in here, what are we supposed to do?
You saw it? What was that?
You're back on Sordid Cinema. That was a clip from The Void, which is a Canadian horror film with a little bit of a sci-fi bent and tons of practical gore. It's difficult to give a plot synopsis of. Essentially, it mostly revolves around a set of mismatched folks, some of whom are a little bit on the psychotic end, holding up in a mostly disused hospital, while a set of aliens, cult beings, something or other, threatens them, while something much more malevolent threatens them from inside of the hospital. There's really not a whole lot more plot than that, unless we want to get into the sort of character dynamics. But, Ricky, I know that I've been hearing about this movie sort of intermittently for the last several weeks as it's been getting a little bit more, I guess, digital and perhaps some theatrical distribution as well. And I've been hearing all these names dropped in terms of, you know, comparing it to John Carpenter and people like that. So at some point I knew we were going to have to talk about it. So, I mean, who in this sort of like genre filmmaker bingo, like who did this movie evoke for you?
Mostly Lucio Fulci. I thought of the movie The Beyond. I mean, there's one specific sequence in which you're going to think of John Carpenter's The Thing, clearly, but mostly Fulci, a lot of H.P. Lovecraft. I'm not actually a big fan of the first two films by this group of filmmakers. I believe they're all based out of Winnipeg here in Canada. I'm not entirely sure, but I could be wrong. Previously, they did Manborg, and they also directed... What is the name of that movie? Father's Day, the remake.
Father's Day, yeah.
Right, which I was a bigger fan of the original. Of those two films, I would prefer Manborg, but this, I think, is the best of the three so far. I was actually pleasantly surprised. This movie has its problems, mostly in the script. Thematically, it's all over the place, but I think it offers a nostalgic rush for fans of low-budget 1980s horror films, and it's kind of bonkers, but in a good way at times. Like, I never could guess what was going to happen next. And that's kind of refreshing because a lot of times horror films feel a little too formulaic. Like, you know exactly where it's going beat by beat, scene by scene. And this feels unhinged. It's completely bonkers, all over the place, off the rails. Two directors here, one of which directed Father's Day. He also worked as an assistant art director for one of my favorite shows of all time, Hannibal. He also worked on Suicide Squad, but he worked on Hannibal. He did a lot of work for Hannibal, which I think is a fantastic TV show. Now, that is Stephen Kostansky. The other director is Jeremy Gillespie, who I'm not familiar with. I don't know if you're a fan of low-budget genre films. I think you might like this movie. Again, it is problematic at times, but there's a lot here to appreciate, which I'll talk about shortly.
Now, Victor, did you initially catch this at After Dark?
No, I caught it at a press screening a few weeks back.
And, I actually don't know, like, do you have the sort of similar genre bona fides as Ricky here? Like, are you into all this stuff?
I absolutely do. I think it actually did the film a disservice to see it in a press screening, because this is totally a film that gets better as the energy in the room increases. You want to see this with a Midnight Madness crowd, if not a Midnight Madness crowd, maybe on the couch with a few of your buddies, because what the film lacks in story, it makes up for in atmosphere and tone.
Yeah, I mean, I can't imagine going to a press screening for this movie. I can definitely imagine seeing it with a Fantasia audience or seeing it with a Midnight Madness audience, but certainly would not fit for a press screening atmosphere. I don't know. I found this movie very frustrating. I think there's elements of it that are fantastic and inventive, and other elements that just bring the whole movie to a halt, sometime for long periods of time. I will say that I totally agree with what you said, Ricky, about not really knowing what to expect. I think one of the movie's strengths is that it goes from about half an hour in, it goes from like 0 to 60 in terms of like weirdness level, where you get a sequence involving this like practical monstrosity that these characters have to battle that would normally be reserved for the last reel of a movie like this. Instead, it comes like really early on, and it really sets up like, wow, how insane is this going to get? And the answer is like pretty insane. Unfortunately, in between the bouts of insanity, there are long stretches where we actually have to spend time with these characters who are unfortunately absolutely the weak point of this film. None of the characters are interesting. Most of the dialogue is quite bad. It's bad. It's not particularly good. And, you know, it tries to shoehorn in these themes about parenthood and you know, regret and loss. And none of that works at all. Like, none of the thematic stuff really works at all. It really only... the gonzo genre elements work, but it's really, really good at them. So, you know, I'm conflicted.
Well, my problem with this is, I totally agree with Simon, is I just didn't feel anything for the characters. I only screened this about 2 or 3 weeks back, and before coming into the podcast, I actually had to rewatch it this weekend because I couldn't remember anything about the characters. The visuals, the atmosphere, the tone stood out, but thinking about what else went along with the movie, I drew a blank. It was instantly forgettable.
Yeah, I mean, I'm on the same page as you guys. I think I just like the movie a lot better than you two, because the thing is, it's like, I just like the fact that they produced this crazy independent, like, Canadian horror film that's quite unlike anything I've seen in a long time. I mean, yeah, it would have been great if they put as much love and attention on plot and characters and structure. What I kind of like about the movie is it does not have structure. Like, the dialogue is weak, the acting isn't so great, it's not terrible. You don't get to know much about the characters, but for a supernatural fright flick, it's, again, bonkers. Like, that's the word I'm going to continue using throughout this podcast. Like, it's just insane. And I think I just, like, admire them being so ambitious. And although it sort of, like, falls apart to some degree, it never had me bored. I was always wondering what would happen next. And it does look good. Like, it still looks low budget. But for a low budget film, aesthetically, like, I think it's pleasing to the eye. Like, I love the whole third act where it reminded me a lot of a Canadian horror film called Beyond the Black Rainbow, which, of course, is a superior film in every single way possible. That's an amazing movie. But it did remind me of Beyond the Black Rainbow in terms of the colors, the triangles, lots of triangles in this movie. I like the idea of how this movie features a madman who has created his house of horrors underneath the hospital. Like, that reminded me a lot of Lucio Fulci's movie, specifically The Beyond. But it's also, like, straight up a slasher movie at times. In terms of, like, the cinematography and the practical effects, I think that is what makes this movie a step above most low-budget genre films. Like, I watch a lot of low-budget horror films, and trust me, a lot of times they're just terrible across the board. Like, not just the acting or script, but even the production values. Like, and here they use a lot of, like, old-school prosthetics. They don't use CGI, at least not that I'm aware of. So that's kind of cool. And I like John Carpenter. So whenever you get a horror film that's reminiscent of an early John Carpenter film, that's always a good thing. Now, the difference between this movie and the movies that it pays tribute to is the fact that those early movies, like even Lucio Fulci's movies, have better scripts. And like that's the thing. Like, it all boils down to the screenplay. So it's like they did everything right except for the screenplay. The screenplay is the weakest element of this film.
To the extent that I would say that the practical effects are so much better than everything else in this movie that it almost feels like a feature-length demo reel for what they can do on a shoestring budget, what I assume is a shoestring budget. It's not just how the effects look, it's how they're filmed and how these creatures move. Everything is unsettling and feels unique, even though it isn't really. Like, none of the creature designs are really, like, nothing, like, I don't know, if you've seen enough, you know, like, sci-fi horror stuff, like, you've seen some similar creature designs, certainly The Thing comes to mind, but, like, a lot of them would just, if they were filmed or lit the wrong way, would just come across silly, particularly the daughter, let's call her that, I don't want to misgender the creature, you know, so things like that could have absolutely come across silly, but they're 100% filmed and designed and lit in the right way. And it's weird that these things are so beautifully done in the most horrible possible way. What when like everything else about the production lags so far behind, and it's really disorienting.
But have you seen the two previous films from Astron 6?
I have not.
Okay, because I'm telling you, this raises the bar for them as a production company in terms of cinematography and practical effects. It is night and day compared to the two previous films. Like, it is a step up by far. So it's positive for them as a group of filmmakers. Like, they seem to be improving and learning from their mistakes. And I don't think it's because of the budget. Like, I think they're working on a similar budget as the first two films. Also, I really like the soundtrack. And I like the widescreen compositions. Like, that is what reminded me a lot of John Carpenter films. Like, there's a lot of beautiful shots, like a lot of long takes in which the camera will follow a character down a narrow hallway, for example, but it just looks great. And the soundtrack I thought was really eerie and creepy. I'm not entirely sure what this movie is about. Like, I really have no idea what this movie is about.
Right. Well, that's why I sort of didn't bother with a plot synopsis. But I mean, I want to talk about the music for a minute, because I noticed that there's a lot of sort of dark ambient artists associated with the soundtrack, including Lustmord, whose stuff I know and like. But I will say, you know, there's other parts of the movie where we get sort of, you know, mock Carpenter stuff with analog synthesizers or, you know, fake analog synthesizers. And I have to say, I'm starting to get a little bit saturated with fake Carpenter soundtracks. I feel like they're so omnipresent now between, like, Stranger Things and The Guest and, like, oh, God, It Follows, yeah, and, like, other movies like true. That.
But with Stranger Things, it's only for the title sequence, like the opening title card, right? Like, it's not like you get that soundtrack throughout the whole entire episode. But I do agree that when it comes to these low-budget genre films these days, like, everyone is trying to use the synth score now.
Yeah, even if you go back a little bit further back than Stranger Things, I think Toronto After Dark 2015 is when I first started to notice a pattern of just hearing these synth-heavy horror scores just coming film after film after film.
Well, even the movie we talked about last week, I Don't Feel at Home in This World Anymore. I mean, that uses synth score.
Yeah, and I mean, I think one of the reasons it's happening, so it's not just the fact that everyone's inspired by Carpenter, it's also the fact that, like, it's a lot cheaper to make a good sounding synth score than it is to, like, hire a bunch of, you know, session musicians and, you know, record a bunch of symphonic instruments, or even to license a bunch of music. So, like, it's not that it's a convenient sort of synergy between, you know, it's easy to produce and it's genre appropriate, and it's also having a bit of a moment. Also, this is also happening, I think, because John Carpenter's soundtracks and his new, like, he's been releasing these new records of lost themes, etc. Like, Carpenter's, he's now becoming better known, actually, for his music than his films. So, you know, this stuff is having kind of a cultural moment, but it's getting a little bit saturated.
But the thing about this movie is it's so strange, because when the movie started, I automatically thought of a Canadian thriller called Cold-Blooded, which takes place in a hospital. It's a really good movie. It's reminiscent of Die Hard. It's not a horror film, but it all takes place in a hospital. It's a Canadian, like, low-budget thriller. And then we get into the second act, and the second act reminded me a lot of, like, John Carpenter, and then towards the end, Lucio Fulci. But then we get into the third act. Like, the screenplay becomes a muddled mix of sci-fi, mystical horror, and googie gaga. Like, I don't understand what the fuck is going on.
Well, like, it's all very, what really confuses the script is their, like, if they'd gone for full impressionistic, like, sort of under the skin style weirdness, I think it actually would have worked a lot better. Unfortunately, the filmmakers try to, like, add in all these character motivations with, like, these, and also about characters about whom we don't care, like, two of whom we watch, like, burn a woman alive in the opening scene, and then, like, we're meant to care about later, which is a very strange decision. But
there's also, like, a backstory.
Well, yeah, exactly. Like, there's all this, you know, we have to get an explanation of, you know, the relationship with the doctor and how the hospital got mostly burnt, and, like, all this plot detail and all these character details that, like, if they jettisoned all that and just leaned in on the weirdness, like, you know, you brought up Beyond the Black Rainbow, which is a perfect parallel, because that's also a movie, you know, about a mad scientist, and that is extremely impressionistic and probably had a script that was, like, 5 pages long. I think that would have been a much better route for them to take.
Well, these guys, the Astron 6 guys, I mean, their other films, I actually think that Manborg had a super micro budget. I think it was, like, $1,000 movie. That they're making, and their films they go so far into the territory of pastiche. They're like the films from the Tarantino Rodriguez Grindhouse trailers. Mm-hmm. They'd be totally at home in that world there. And it's like they're overcompensating. They swung in the opposite direction and they went a little too hard trying to get away from what they were doing before. And this film comes off, it's just, like, tonally flat. Like, you get the same thing from beginning to end. And I feel like it's a little bit exhausting. The film doesn't offer any valleys and peaks, and if they put, like, maybe 10% of that wackiness that they put into their other films, I think they'd be coming much closer to having a great movie.
Yeah, that is true, because this film I don't remember there being even one line of dialogue that was funny. Like, it does not have a funny bone in its body. And I think they could have had a lot more fun with this film. It could have been a bit more campy because it is very serious. Like, it's reminiscent of those 80s horror films, but not like, not the 80s horror films in which you like that add like a touch of humor. It's not like, like, for example, Evil Dead 2, right? It's straight up like, this is a horror film. There's a mad scientist. There's a lot of gore, a lot of blood, a lot of creatures. It all looks good, but it's like they're not having fun with the movie.
Yeah, it's very grim, which is like a weird... You don't usually expect a movie with these kind of creature effects to be grim. Which is, based on what you said, Victor, it seems like they're still trying to figure out the balance between sort of pastiche and sort of originality, or to like craft an original vision which features characters you might care about. And they really spend a lot of time trying to make us invest in these characters. And that's really like where the movie falls apart for me, which is unfortunately like over half the running time.
But you know, that's the problem with filmmakers these days like this. Like, there's too many filmmakers that don't have their own voice. Like, they are basically imitating their favorite filmmakers from the past, like imitating the movies that they love watching when they were growing up. You know, everyone's trying to be like Tarantino. But the thing is, when you watch a Tarantino film, it is a Tarantino film. There's no question about it. You know you're watching a Tarantino film because he has his own unique voice. Like, it's not just the directorial flourishes. It's not just the way he directs his cast. It's not just like his script and his dialogue. It's just, it's what, who he is. Like, he, it's purely a Tarantino film. When you watch a lot of these young filmmakers these days, you can't, like, you know, you read the reviews or you listen to a podcast review of the movie, and all you hear is like the references to Clive Barker, to Lucio Fulci, to John Carpenter, to H.P. Lovecraft. And that's the problem. Like, I'm not entirely sure if these guys have anything to say that's original. And that's a problem for, I mean, this is the third film, and I do like this film enough to recommend it. By far, out of the three films, it's the only one I like. But, you know, compared to Sean Byrne, and we're going to talk about his movie, The Devil's Candy, next, like, that's a guy who knows his horror films, who loves his horror films, but he has a unique voice, and as a filmmaker, his movies feel and seem different.
Right. And I think of this as a weird connection to make, but I think of guys like Tarsem, who, you know, used to work in production design or costuming or something, and then decided to make their own movies, which are, at least in my opinion, not very good. And these guys are obviously geniuses in terms of, you know, certain aspects of production. And again, like, this, the parts of the movie that work do feel like sort of a glorified demo reel. And I almost hope that this movie gets them work, you know, working for other filmmakers on like on more interesting projects, and then like making them really sing.
But they do work on more interesting projects. Mm-hmm. Like I said, one of the directors is one of the, or was one of the art directors for Hannibal, which is one of the greatest shows ever made. But the thing is, when we think of these filmmakers and these movies, we think of the production house Astron 6. So it's a group of people, right? And that's what I mean. There isn't one specific vision here. Like, there's two filmmakers, two directors, I'm assuming two, if not three, screenplay writers. And that is why the movie, as fun as it is to watch, feels like a hot mess, because it feels like the first act is maybe so-and-so's vision, and the second act is this guy directing, and the third act is someone completely different.
Yeah. No, I can't disagree with that. It does have a certain committee feel, albeit a committee of like truly deranged individuals.
Mm-hmm.
All right, so unless there's any more comments that need be made, the movie is called The Void, and I believe it's kicking around on VOD/Netflix, places like that.
It got a theatrical release, though.
Did it?
I highly recommend people check out this movie. If you're listening to the Sorted Cinema podcast, you love genre films, and I recommend it. Like, it's well worth the watch.
They come so close to getting it right that it's frustrating, right? Like, yeah. They're so close to having a really, really great all-around movie. And as much as we're kind of kicking on the film, like, I enjoyed it. I recommend it, and I'm excited to see what they do next.
Yeah. You know what's funny is we keep ragging on movies for their endings, but this movie actually is most interesting at the end, and it actually has a great set of final shots.
Yeah.
So, you know, I'm at least going to give it that.
the first time in the history of the podcast in which a third act is the best part of the movie.
Yeah. Anyway, movie's called The Void. Check it out, especially if you're into Canadian genre film or any of the touchstones we mentioned. Boom. All right, so we're going to take a quick break. We're going to hear a clip from our second film of the hour. It's called The Devil's Candy. We'll be right back.
Beverly, what? Jesus Christ. What the fuck are you doing, Beth? Beverly?
This isn't my face.
What? Bev. No, no, don't do that. Bev! Put the scissors down. Look at me! Bev, okay, stop!
It's not me.
No, 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 don't do that. Bev.
Can you help me?
Bev, stop! No, 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 Beverly, stop!
That is Satan's lie, to distract us from the reality of who he is.
Hey, what's going on?
It's like it flowed through me. I don't remember painting this.
This is Mommy and Daddy's house. They're dead.
Oh my God, I'm so sorry.
I need to come home now.
We are his pawns. We are his demons on Earth. He uses us to carry out his unspeakable deeds. We satiate his hunger.
Your latest work is wonderfully disturbing.
Oh my God.
I didn't mean to do this.
To sacrifice.
He will slither into your soul. He is no mask in a Halloween store. He's not what you see in the movies. He is an active, violent, personal reality.
Just the gas?
He's right. You are the sweetest candy of them all.
That was a clip from our second film of the hour. It's Sean Burns' The Devil's Candy. And as I mentioned, regrettably, in the opening, I have not seen this film, but I am very excited to hear about it because I'm a huge... huge fan of The Loved Ones, which we reviewed on the podcast a very long time ago. And I remember that being one of my favorite Fantasia screenings ever. Now, Ricky, as I understand it, there was a little bit of release drama with this film where it had a re-edit between Fest screening and VOD release. Did you happen to notice any differences between any versions?
Yeah. Okay. First of all, we watched The Loved Ones, the world premiere at the Toronto International Film Festival.
Oh, did not we?
And that was 8 years before The Devil's Candy was released. And it was my favorite film of that year. It's one of my favorite horror films of all time. So if you haven't seen The Loved Ones, you need to watch The Loved Ones. It's amazing. As far as The Devil's Candy goes, this was released, I believe, 3 years ago. When I first saw the movie, I saw it at Fantasia. And it was, I believe, 95 minutes long. And my biggest gripe with this film was I felt it dragged at times. Like, it was a little too long, and there was like elements about the version I saw that I just did not like. Like, I didn't think it was as fun and tight, and it didn't flow as well as his first film. And so for me, it was somewhat of a sophomore slump. Now, the thing is, I watched it again this week, and this time I saw the theatrical cut, and it's far better. Like, so they basically trimmed it from 90 minutes or 95 minutes to 71 minutes, and it's a better film for doing so.
71 minutes, that is svelte.
79
minutes. Okay. But yeah, apparently it screened at Fantasia 2016. Okay. So I mean, tell me about this movie. What's it about? Why should I care? I mean, I know why I should care, but give me the elevator pitch.
Okay, well, it's about a struggling painter. He becomes possessed by Satan or satanic forces after he and his family move into their dream house in Texas. That's your 30-second elevator pitch. Now, the thing is, that's a simple way to describe the movie. But the thing about this film is what it does better than most horror films is it actually has a good script, Simon. It has a really, really good script. It has great dialogue. It has great conversations between the characters that we follow throughout this 79 minutes. It has a great cast who all perform well. Like, the performances across the board are fantastic, especially from the main actor. Ethan Embry plays Jesse, the painter, and he is fantastic in the film. And so it's a complete opposite of what we get from The Void, in the sense where The Void looks cool. It's got interesting, like, cinematography. It's got practical effects. It's gory. It's crazy all over the place. You never know where it's going from scene to scene. You're always guessing as to what's going to happen next. This is pretty straightforward. And the thing is, although it deals with these satanic forces, it really is like a home invasion film, because the way the movie starts is we get a scene that takes place in the past, and there is a man who's mentally disturbed, and he hears voices in his head, and he kills his parents. And so, of course, you know, he's forced to move out, because I don't think they actually knew that he was responsible for the killing of his parents. But Victor, correct me if I'm wrong. They suspect he's responsible, but he never got charged or put in incarcerated, right?
No, they put him in an institution. They thought that the mother fell down a flight of stairs and then the father killed himself. So I'm pretty sure they didn't think he did it.
Right. So this takes place in the near future, and they move into the house when the house is put for sale because his parents were murdered. And he escapes the mental institution, goes back to his home, wants to move back in, and starts to terrorize his family. Meanwhile, the dad, who's a painter, is trying his best to sell these paintings to places like, say, like a bank, because he's trying to make enough money for them to actually pay for this house that they just moved into. So think of like Rosemary's Baby, but flip it. So instead of it being about the mom and the fears of being like a parent, in this case, like a mom, it's flipped to the point where it focuses more on the dad. And it's like, I think the first time I've watched a horror film where instead of focusing on the mom and her fears of being a parent, it focuses on the dad. And that's what makes it interesting. Plus, you know, the fact that he's such a great actor.
I cared about these people, like, right from the onset. And there's the relationship between the father and the daughter. It just draws you in. It's touching, it's moving, and it's not the sort of relationship you see very often in a horror movie. And when I see a movie, one of the things I judge it by is the little character-defining moments. So in Jaws, you think of Roy Scheider sitting there, you know, pantomiming at his son at the table, or even Avengers Age of Ultron, when they're all sitting around a table trying to pick up Thor's hammer. It's those little moments that kind of draw you in and make you care. And I feel like The Devil's Candy was great at putting some of those family moments in when things slowed down to make you care that much more when the intensity picked up.
Well, and again, that's what makes it interesting. It's the relationship between the dad and the daughter. And again, it's rare to see this in a horror film. Like, usually it focuses on the mom and her bond with her children. In this case, it's all about the dad. And it focuses, like, it is a horror film. The two characters, the mentally deranged guy who used to live in the house and the dad who moves into the house, they do hear voices in their head that drives them slowly crazy. And in the case of the dad, what happens is he starts painting this beautiful mural. And Simon, like, the best thing about this movie is the actual painting itself. It's fucking amazing. And so he just gets possessed. Like, he becomes obsessed with painting this mural. And when he gets to work, he loses track of time. So, like, 3 hours can go by and he's still painting because he's just so obsessed. Like, it's like he gets possessed. But the thing is, the movie is really about his relationship with his family, specifically his daughter. And so he has to protect his daughter against the danger of this deranged man who goes back to visit and eventually kidnaps her. But he's also trying to protect his own career. And the best part of this movie is when he finally gets a phone call from this, like, it's not a museum, but it's a place where it's like an exhibition house for, like, artists, right, to showcase their work. And so he finally gets a phone call from them because they like what he's finally doing, like this crazy painting that he's currently working on. They want to pay him big bucks for it. And he has to make this tough choice of, does he pick up his daughter at school or does he show up to secure this business deal with this company? And he makes a choice, and that's sort of like where the movie spirals out of control.
So I've also heard this movie is very metal. Is that true?
Yeah, big time. And you know, the thing is I don't know why they do not make more horror films with a heavy metal soundtrack and or about heavy metal music, because there's, like, the two go hand in hand. And, like, even when you think of a band like Black Sabbath, right? Like, that's a band that named the band Black Sabbath because they were practicing across the street from a theater. That theater was screening Mario Bava's classic horror film, Black Sabbath, right? And just in terms of, like, music videos and the artwork for albums like Iron Maiden and so on and so forth, like Misfits, you know, I just don't know why they do not make more horror films that revolve around the metal scene and or have a heavy metal soundtrack. Like, recently we've seen some, like, we've seen Deathgasm, which I really liked, but this movie is so metal, and I think that's why you would like it. Not just, like, the soundtrack, but thematically it really does fit with the overall story.
How does the metal stuff tie in?
Well, because the actual dad, he's a musician. He's not just a painter, but he's a musician, and his daughter is a musician and she plays guitar. And so throughout the whole entire film, like, you do see her perform, like, she is jamming and she wants the specific guitar. And it completely ties in because the family, it's not like your traditional, like, I don't know, white American family that listens to God knows what, like country music or something. Like, the dude, like, Ethan Embry, like, his character, he's covered in tattoos. He's got long hair. He looks like Jesus Christ, like, at times. And the daughter, Zoe, like, she's big time into metal. If there's one specific scene when they drive to the dream house before they buy it, they're in the car and they're just listening to metal music. Like, and well, it's the way they incorporate metal into the movie. It's not just the soundtrack. Like, it's part of the film. It's part of the DNA of this film.
The film's villain as well, he has to play metal really loud to keep the demon voices out of his head. And that's how the film kicks off.
Yeah.
That's kind of an amusing, ironic reversal when you consider that, you know, in the early 90s, I forget which band it was, but, you know, there was specifically a band that was sued because, you know, people thought that there were backmasked satanic messages in music. So having someone drown out, you know, demon voices with metal is kind of a nice ironic reversal.
We're not entirely sure why they become possessed. Like, for example, in a movie like Lords of Salem, the Rob Zombie film, it's the music that is responsible for them sort of like going crazy. That's why they become possessed, right? It's because they hear the music. In this movie, I don't know, Victor, maybe you can chime in here, but it's never made clear if it's the actual house and or if it's the music and or if it's a combination of the two.
No, they leave it pretty vague. It's all open to interpretation.
It is. And the thing we should also mention is that Okay, so the main character in a film, when he's obsessed with painting this huge mural, right? He's painting like these dead children, and he doesn't understand why. It just, it takes over him, mind, body, and soul, and he starts painting away, and he paints these dead children. And eventually he starts painting his daughter, and she's burning. And so what we find out later in the movie is that the paintings are inspired by actual crimes that were committed by this man, the man who lived there prior to him.
So it also said, I mean, it seems like there's a lot going on. It sounds like it connects to the loved ones in terms of horror movies about family and family dynamics. But it also sounds like it's about sort of another sort of classic movie subject, which is, you know, sort of obsession and the artistic process and, you know, the lines people may or may not have to cross for their art. Is that about right?
Yeah, but again,
selling out is a big theme.
It is because like that moment that I talked about before, in which he has to make a decision. Does he show up at his business meeting or does he pick up his daughter at school? He's like at a crossroad, right? And he has to figure out which direction he needs to take. And the thing is, there is a bit of personal gain involved, right? Like he does want to become famous. He wants to be recognized as like an artist. He wants to get paid for his work, and he wants to paint what he wants to paint, right? Like at the start of the movie, he's painting butterflies because that's what he needs to do for the client he's working for, but that's not necessarily what he wants to do. And so it's an interesting examination of how, as parents these days, you have to balance your family life with your career, because you do need to make money in order for your family to get by, in order to pay for your bills, your house, the food on the table, et cetera, et cetera. And that's what I find interesting about it, because it is a horror film, but you're right, Simon, it really does focus on this family, and much like the loved ones, but in a different way. But the main focus is of the family. And I think like even like the painting, like there's a nice parallel between the painting, the music, and the fact that these two men become possessed. Because like I said, like as an artist, especially a painter, he's obsessed with his work, like to the point where when it comes to priorities, sometimes, you know, his priorities are out of whack because the daughter and his wife should be his priority, but it's not. It's his painting. It's his work. And that's the problem with being a struggling artist and an artist in general, someone who's so passionate about his work. Like you do at one point in your life, because of society, you have to sort of like make these hard decisions.
The other thing I sort of wanted to hone in on is, you know, how many times, Ricky, have you and I gone to, especially genre film fests, and watched movies and said, you know, this would have been great if they'd asked, you know, 20 minutes, you know, that there could have been a really tight movie there, but they ended up just sort of, you know, not necessarily highlighting their best material. And it sounds like, you know, Sean Byrne and company, you know, took some constructive criticism, went back and really, you know, boiled down the movie to its essentials. Like, what did you notice about the difference between the cuts?
Well, I mean, honestly, there was a lot of repetition in the original cut I watched. Like there's a lot of scenes of watching him paint half naked. You know, he hears voices in his head. It's just a lot of padding for no reason. And so this just feels like a tighter script. And I like the way, I don't know, it just flows better. Because like even like with both men in this movie who are possessed and hear voices in their heads, it's interesting the way he connects the two characters. Like they're completely different and yet a lot alike. And it's this idea about how humans can become like vessels for, in this case, like something dark and seated. And like, I mean, again, it's never really explained why they act the way they do, but it's just, it's interesting. Like, I don't know. I think it's like two different men who are completely opposite, but they're easy targets for demonic possession for different reasons. So even like again, that's why his occupation is interesting. Like it's like the fact that he's a painter, like painting itself is kind of like an obsession. And also like the fact that he loves metal music, it's just this perfect combination. And I got to tell you, Simon, like I wasn't a big fan of the movie when I first watched it, but watching the director's cut, I guess you would call it, or the theatrical cut or the DVD cut or the VOD cut, whatever you want to call it, I got to tell you, it's a much, much better film. So it's good to know that maybe he listened to some feedback. Maybe he read some reviews and decided that, you know what, we got to cut it back. Because when I walked out of Fantasia, that was like everyone said the only problem with this movie was the fact that it was too long for no reason.
And that's kind of a rare thing. I mean, so often in the past, you know, you encounter filmmakers who screen their work and then they get criticism and they get prideful and they get resentful about what they hear, and they stick to their guns and they double down and say, well, it's my vision and I don't want to compromise and I don't want to change anything. So being able to, you know, take a step back and say, hey, maybe the movie does need an edit, I think is really admirable.
Yeah. And, you know, we talk a lot about these genre films that are like a hybrid of, say, like a slasher film and a zombie film and a vampire film. This is interesting because it's a mix between the typical satanic haunted house thriller and home invasion siege nightmare. And I can't recall the last time I saw a movie like this.
Yeah, I mean, having not seen this one, I mean, Don't Breathe kind of did a flip on a home invasion where it you know, it does a predator versus prey, you know, back and forth and adds new elements, but certainly doesn't sound quite like this. Anyway, anything else that we wanted to mention about the movie before we wrap up?
It's just an enjoyable all-around film. If you're a fan of genre movies, you want something a little bit different, a little bit exciting, I definitely recommend it.
All right. Movie's called The Devil's Candy. We got 2 out of 2 recommendations. Honestly, probably would have been 3 out of 3 because I can't imagine being a metal fan, being a fan of Sean Byrne's previous film, I can't imagine that I wouldn't have loved it as well. Is kicking around on VOD, so do check it out. And a little bit more of a mixed recommendation for The Void, but I think I can definitely say if you have any interest in practical effects and, like, you know, gonzo sci-fi horror in general, you should definitely check it out. And that's about it from us. Do, if you haven't already, rate, review, subscribe on iTunes, Stitcher, whatever your provider of choice is, and visit us at sordidcinema.com. I'm on Twitter at HollowMinds. Ricky runs the Goomba Stomp Mag and Sordid Cinema Twitter accounts. Victor, are you on Twitter?
I am. You can find me at Victor J. Stiff.
Fantastic. That's it from us. Do visit us at sordidcinema.com. We got all kinds of content going up all the time. And thank you all so very much once again, as always, for listening. We'll be back next week. We'll be right back.